Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, and may it please the court. My name is Bernard O'Donnell. We're here on behalf of Sean Daly, who was convicted in the Superior Court in Newcastle County of three counts of rape second degree and sentenced to 45 years imprisonment. We've raised three issues in the opening brief. I'd like to address two of them this morning in the time available. The first issue I'd like to address is the admissibility of the out-of-court video statement of the complainant at the Children's Center.
Advocacy Center,
pardon me. I should be able to remember that word. The defense argued below that there was an insufficient foundation for the admissibility of this statement because the child's testimony in court failed to establish the foundational requirements under some of the court's prior jurisprudence interpreting 3507. One of the requirements is that the defendant must testify as to the truthfulness of the statement. As we pointed out in the opening brief, the testimony was almost altogether absent insofar as the child's testimony regarding her truthfulness during the out-of-court statement.
Well, if a witness says what I said out of court is false, you're saying that as a result of that testimony, the 3507 statement is inadmissible?
Under those circumstances, it would possibly be admissible because they've addressed the truthfulness of it and said it's false. So
okay.
It gives an opportunity.
That helps me understand your argument. So it has to be covered either as true or false or...
Correct.
Okay.
In addition, the witness's in-court testimony must touch upon the events perceived or heard and the out-of-court statement itself. Well, it didn't address the out-of-court statement itself.
Can you explain that phrase to me? I should know the answer to this, but it'll be helpful if you can help me through it. There are two thoughts in that comment, and it is what the cases say from time to time. Does it mean the witness, while on the stand, has to touch on the subject matter as it's related in the statement itself, or that the witness simply has to demonstrate that they remember events as they occurred that are touched upon in the statement? Am I making myself clear? Do they have to say in the statement, the moon was up? But I really don't remember whether the sun or the moon was up. But then they say, when the incident that the statement talks about occurred, I now have an independent recollection that the sun was up. But I don't know what the statement says about that.
Well,
to what extent is touching on the events perceived, the events in fact, or the events as related in the statement, is my question.
I don't think those two concerns are necessarily the antithesis of each other, and I think there's some overlap. If the in-court testimony addresses the events perceived in the out-of-court statement, that is sufficient if it corroborates it.
That answers my question. Okay. That's the logical response, and I think I was twisting this beyond necessity, but... We agree then.
Now, one of the things that's difficult in these circumstances under 3507, I think, is that 3507 is a derogation of the common law. And we know under Crawford that the opportunity for cross-examination is sufficient to satisfy the Sixth Amendment, the abstract proposition to that effect. And we know that this court previously recognized that in its analysis under 3507 that an opportunity for cross-examination is required in the Smith decision and other decisions. But at some point, there's almost a line that needs to be drawn between the opportunity, says, for cross-examination and, says, the quality, says, of cross-examination. Although Crawford, for example, states the an opportunity for cross-examination is needed, and it doesn't guarantee any quality of cross-examination, it's troubling in some circumstances, we haven't addressed that occasion yet where a witness
We have one case, don't we, that goes so far as to say that an amnesiac on the stand is an opportunity to cross-examine. Now, tell me where you draw the line if the precedent says somebody who has no memory at all is someone you have the opportunity to cross-examine. And they say, I just don't know what you're talking about.
That is troubling. This is a person who is unconscious, for example. If we wheel the person, the declarant, in on a stretcher, is that an opportunity for cross-examination? I know we've said in the past that someone suffering, the United States Supreme Court has said in the past that someone suffering, says, from amnesia can be, there's an opportunity for cross-examination. But that's a situation where the person had a memory, could testify, says, in court, but simply because of being struck in the head, I think that's the Supreme Court case Your Honor is thinking about. I can't remember the name. It was a prison guard who was assaulted and struck in the head, and he had no his recollection concerning at the time. But shortly after he was struck in the head, he did give a statement concerning who had struck him.
If that's the case, though, where do we go with the test of the quality of the opportunity? That no opportunity at all okay, then where do you go beyond that?
Well, in that case, I would say that the defense has an opportunity to cross-examine the prison guard who's been assaulted and has amnesia concerning the specific event. At least that is before the jury.
Mr. O'Donnell, I just need to get oriented as to where you are in your argument. First, we were talking about the absence of testimony of the child regarding the truth of the statement and whether or not the in-court testimony touches on the out-of-court statement. And now we're talking about something that we're talking about, the Sixth Amendment.
I understand your concern, Your Honor. The point I was, I guess, trying to make, and if I may try to come back on a tangent, the point I was trying to make that in a situation where the witness in court doesn't provide a sufficient foundation, that raises the very concerns that the court has previously recognized under 3507, which the United States Supreme Court and this court has addressed in collateral situations under the Sixth Amendment. I went a little far afield, but that was the point I was trying to make.
Are you contending that there's a constitutional issue now?
Well, I don't want to. It wasn't raised in the briefing, and to the extent that, and so I don't think it can be decided necessarily on constitutional grounds. It has to be decided on 3507, but the court's analysis under 3507 has protected Sixth Amendment values, previously the way the court has interpreted 3507. After all, it's a derogation of the common law.
Well, how did the Superior Court address the argument you're making now, and what's wrong with its reasoning?
Well, the Superior Court has found that there was a sufficient foundation.
Just like that, or wasn't there?
No, there was. I'm not saying there was no analysis whatsoever. At first, the court was concerned and said that the statement didn't address the in-court testimony says didn't address whether whether the out-of-court statement was truthful or not. But then there were some follow-up questions on cross-examination, and this is one of the difficulties here too. There were no objections to those follow-up questions. But they were, as pointed out in the brief, leading questions. And had those leading questions and answers been objected to, there would have been no evidence whatsoever to support the admission for the foundation of the admission of the 3507 statements. The second issue I would like to address is the issue concerning...
Well, before you get to the second issue, Mr. O'Donnell, what is the flaw, if any, in the... lower court's ruling regarding foundation?
The flaw in the lower court's ruling is that the evidentiary record says didn't support the ruling that there was a sufficient foundation under 3507. We're not arguing that it was a an error insofar as applying precepts of law.
Is it accurate to say that during the examination the victim indicated that the defendant had at the very least exposed himself to her and that she had told that to her mother and grandmother, and that she also confirmed that the defendant tried to, quote, touch her butt, unquote, with his penis?
Yes, the record does confirm that.
And that is, as a matter of law, insufficient to touch on the subject matter of the 3507 statement?
Well, she didn't tie that in with her, says, out-of-court statement, says the video statement, as required.
All right, help me with that. I'm okay. Not following that point.
There was testimony, and much of it was in response to leading questioning, but that there had been sexual conduct of some sort, and she did identify, says her father. There was an exposure, there was a touching, says et cetera.
And that was also in the 3507 statement, wasn't it?
Yes.
Okay, so is it that she didn't explain or touch on everything in the 3507?
She didn't.
Is your argument?
Yes.
So is there a threshold that one must reach? Must it be 100% or 90% or 50%?
No, I don't know, Your Honor. I just don't think we simply don't think there's enough here. Insofar as the issue concerning the closing argument and the shifting of the burden of proof, I'd like to address, says that the defense objected to part of the prosecution argument and contended before the trial court that the prosecution was shifting the burden of proof. What essentially happened, factually speaking, is that the defendant's mother testified at some length concerning that she and the defendant had taken as the child to a family counseling center and also to the A.I. DuPont Hospital in order to have investigated that the child had been sexually molested, possibly by her own siblings, because the grandmother said that the child had made complaints to the grandmother, says, about that. The defense... The defense put that evidence in, and the state attempted to rebut it by calling a witness from the Child Advocacy Center, Dr. DeJong, Children and Families First, Dr. Kelly from Children and Families First, and also another witness to say that they had no records of such a complaint by the complainant's family. Now, one thing in support of the complaint is that the family doctor, the pediatrician, they had first taken the child to the pediatrician, and within days after took her to AI and Children and Families First. The evidence concerning the visit to the pediatrician was confirmed because before trial, pursuant to stipulation, the family pediatrician, the child's pediatrician, had written a letter that was admitted by stipulation saying that they had been there to report a complaint of alleged sexual abuse. So you know, it was not an unreasonable inference that they would have, therefore, taken the child to A.I. DuPont, Children's Advocacy Center, pursuant to the doctor's instructions. Perhaps because of miscommunications problems, whatever, there didn't appear to be any evidence concerning, corroborating evidence, documentary evidence that the child had been seen at CAC or Children and Families First But the state, in its closing arguments, has appeared to shift the burden of proof in that respect to the...
By doing what?
Well, this is the statement. Mr. Fasciola suggested to you that we don't know what transpired when Vivian supposedly took the child to AI and to Children and Families First. The state would suggest, yeah, we do know. She never went there. That's what transpired, and while the there may have been errors on dates and all that type of thing going back and forth, if you're not in the database, what difference does it make what the date was? If you're not in the database, it doesn't matter. The defense objected that this was shifting the burden of proof to suggest that the defense had the burden of proving that there was no entries in, or that there had been corroborating documentary evidence of these complaints.
Why isn't it just a fair comment on the credibility of the witnesses who offered that evidence?
Well, that's an interesting point. Although it wasn't made in the opening brief, I'd suggest that there's an air here of, insofar as improper closing argument, there's an implication here of superior knowledge concerning, says, the facts and evidence. The state would suggest, yeah, we do know. The prosecutor is telling the jury, yeah, we do know that she didn't, suggesting that there's some other evidence that they weren't able to get in or wasn't in there that proves that there was never any complaint, that this was bogus.
Well, there's more than one way to interpret that comment, though, isn't it fair to say?
There is, but our contention is that the more likely interpretation by the jury would be that the prosecutor is implying superior knowledge by just that direct statement. Yeah, we do know.
You have less than 3 minutes left. Are you not going to address the Getz or the Sixth Amendment issues?
There's one other point I'd like to make with respect to that. Insofar as that issue, the defense asked for a curative instruction to just correct that error, and the court declined to give the curative instruction because it found there was no error. We contend that there was, and in the Perkins case, the court affirmed what the trial court did in that case because there was a curative instruction under similar circumstances, and that's the error here. Had there been a curative instruction at that point, contemporaneous, but the fact that the court ruled that there was no error precluded the curative instruction.
Do you have the appendix reference to the requested instruction that was denied?
I don't think there was. It's at A83. I don't think there was a requested instruction because the trial court ruled that there was no error. So there would have been no.
The curative instruction that was requested, does that appear anywhere in the record?
No, sir. I didn't see it. The defense objected to, says, the argument or the contentions in the closing argument, and the trial court ruled that there was no error.
Okay.
If I were in that position, I'd say there's no point in asking for a requested instruction because the court just said there was no error.
I understand.
Insofar as the other argument two, says concerning 609, I believe Your Honor had a question about that, says that impeachment of the defendant. The state pointed out in its answering brief the court's prior decisions on that, the Fennell decision and so forth, that wasn't argued in the opening brief. And I'm not going to address that this morning because the state's correct that the court previously ruled on that, and we did not argue that it should be overruled. The federal decisions. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, James Wakely on behalf of the state of Delaware. Addressing Mr. Daly's first argument, the foundation for the admission of the victim's statement under 3507 was properly laid here. Over the past 30 years, this court has sought to explain the steps that the state must take when seeking to admit such a statement. Among the requirements are that the witness whose statement will be admitted must be in court and subject to cross-examination. Obviously, that was the case here. Second, a direct examination must turn on the events perceived and the statement given. Clearly, her testimony at trial was not as specific as perhaps Mr. Daly would have preferred. However, it did, as Justice Ridgely pointed out, touch on the events perceived, the events of her attack.
Well, only some of them.
Only some of it.
So what's required?
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest that this court's case and decision in Falik is instructive on this point. In Falik, the victim merely testified that her father did something bad to her, and this court found that that was sufficient to establish that it had touched, that her testimony had touched and concerned the events of her attack.
So a single sentence that somehow encompasses accusatory conduct or an accusation against the defendant is enough.
Well, in that case, that appears to be the case. However, this court has also said, in cases where the witness does not recall the attack, does not recall any of it, that the failure of knowledge or the lack of memory is not sufficient basis to hold out the 3507 statement. And that's in the two Johnson cases that I've cited, the one from 1975 and the one from 2005. That's also present in Burke, where the witness either does not recall the attack itself or the statement itself. The third requirement under 3507 is the statement is made voluntarily.
Are you contending that those cases are the most on point here because of the lack of memory of the child witness?
I would suggest, Your Honor, yes. That the lack of memory of giving the statement, certainly, does not suggest that the statement cannot be admitted pursuant to 3507, especially under the circumstances of this case, as opposed to the circumstances of Ray, which opposing counsel relies heavily on in his brief.
You were speaking of the third requirement.
The third requirement is that the statement be made voluntarily. Because of the child's young age, the state showed that the statement was made voluntarily by speaking with the victim's mother, who testified that she took the victim to the CAC voluntarily and that she spoke voluntarily. And the final requirement is that the victim be in, or the witness be in court during the playing of the tape. And again, that was clearly the circumstance here.
I thought that was already mentioned by you as the first requirement.
Well, no, it's that she be present as a witness in court and be subject to cross-examination.
What about an alleged requirement that the witness testify about the truth or falsity of the statement?
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest that that requirement simply, to the extent that it is a foundational requirement of 3507, the purpose of 3507 and that requirement would be antithetical in a case where the witness does not remember giving the statement at all. This court in Marion Johnson and Larry Johnson and Burke.
Well, this witness remembered being shown something during an interview, didn't she?
Vaguely. She did not, however, remember speaking to the witness, the interviewer, Ms. Kaiser.
And she saw the videotape of the interview?
Yes, she did, Your Honor.
And yet she didn't comment on whether the videotape she had just seen of the interview was truthful or false?
She did not recall giving the statement even after having seen it.
Was she asked? She was asked.
What's the answer to my question? Did she or did she not say that the videotape I just saw was truthful comment about the events or false comments about the events or words to that effect?
She did not comment on
that. She wasn't asked about that?
Not as far as I'm aware, Your Honor.
Okay. Now explain to me how that point of the foundation was therefore laid.
Well, Your Honor, in a case where the victim doesn't remember giving the statement, prior to the admission of the statement, when the foundation must be laid, it simply makes no logical sense to ask her, what did you tell the truth in the statement you don't recall?
Okay.
The court's decision in Ray can be easily distinguished from the circumstances of this case. Ray was unique in, again, it had a young child victim. However, on direct testimony, the child victim refused to testify about the circumstances of her attack. She testified that the statement that she made to her aunt and to the police officer was true, but refused to elaborate on what she said. And there was, in that case, no physical proof of what she had said to either the aunt or to the police officer. She did testify that the statement that she made was truthful, and the state would suggest that that was the basis for the veracity requirement that the court laid out in its holding. This court then abrogated that in Moore several years later, where they said there was no requirement to testify as to the veracity of the statement. In conclusion, the state would suggest that to the extent that it is a requirement that she testify as to the veracity of the statement, she testified that she understood the difference between a truth and a lie, and that that was sufficient.
Can it be done, Ray, with Moore versus State? Because in Moore, this court apparently said under 3507 there is no requirement that the witness either affirm the truthfulness of the out-of-court statement or offer consistent trial testimony.
Your Honor, I would suggest that the language in Ray was based upon the specific factual circumstances of Ray. And this court's decision in Moore was reaffirming the general principle that there need not be any testimony one way or the other about veracity, specifically because of the purpose of 3507, the turncoat witness or the forgetful witness. So the state would suggest that the language in Moore represents the actual requirement, that there is no requirement to testify this about this, and the language in Ray specifically touched on what the witness in Ray had testified to. Moving now to the third argument, the state did not impermissibly shift the burden when, in closing, the prosecutor commented that there was no evidence to support Mr. Daly's claim that he and his mother had taken the victim to various doctors other than Dr. Vidaja, I believe was her name. It was central to the defense case, apparently, that Ms. Rhode had taken SD to these two doctors and had called the DFS worker. It was apparently, and the state is uncertain precisely the theory under which they operated, a defense of retribution by the mother for either Mr. Daly getting engaged to another woman or for a prior complaint made to DFS about some abuse involving her brothers. At least 10 times this sequence of events was repeated in the examination of the various witnesses. A substantial portion of Ms. Rhone's testimony was entirely concerning this. The state, in rebuttal and on direct examination, Ms. Rhone specified by name a DFS worker she claimed to have contacted about the circumstances of this molestation between she and her SD and her brothers. In rebuttal, the state, in an attempt to rebut the prime theory of defense, as it appeared, called representative from AI DuPont Hospital, who had no record of SD ever being seen there, aside from the most recent CAC interview, called a representative from Children and Families First, who had no recollection or record of ever having seen SD, and called the DFS worker named specifically by Ms. Rhone, who not only testified that he did not have any record of this, but that Ms. Rhone's recollection that as part of a larger conversation she had discussed this allegation of abuse with him was simply not credible because he would never have such a conversation. Even if he did, he would have to report it immediately, and there was no record of any report. The state would suggest that this is that the comments, the rebuttal testimony, and the comments made by the prosecutor in closing were fair comment on the evidence. This was the central issue in the defense, and the state didn't shift the burden. It called witnesses that were unobjected to testify. There is no record of this. and commented on that evidence in closing. And in no way did that shift the burden to the defendant.
I have a question. Although Mr. O'Donnell didn't dwell on it, I want to talk for a minute about the Getz argument. And the scenario, at least as I understand it, which perhaps you can explain to me if I have it wrong, apparently the defense was concerned about a prior conviction being admitted and addressed that issue with the trial judge. And the trial judge's response was not to rule, not to touch on all of the Getz factors, but to suggest to defense counsel that if he did, he would probably, looking at only one of the Getz factors, conclude that the prior conviction would come in because its probative value outweighed any prejudice, and that the defense should therefore talk in a cautionary way with the defendant to make sure the defendant understood the risk of testifying in the face of the probability of a prior conviction being admitted. Now, explain to me why that procedure didn't have a chilling effect on the defendant's free, voluntary exercise of his constitutional right to testify or not testify. Why isn't that a substantial constitutional issue?
Well, Your Honor, the state would suggest that in the cases where this has been brought up before, there was a substantial sequence of events that led up to the court's ruling. Here, the court suggested that he speak with his client, however, made no indication, the judge made no indication that he would not reconsider his putative ruling, that he would not go through the entire Getz factors, merely that he might want to discuss with his client the possibility that this will come in. The circumstances in Fennell and Walker both were motions in limine to discuss the issue, to fully flesh it out, and as the federal cases that those courts cited to note, there's no indication that the court wouldn't have changed its mind, that a more full understanding of the facts fleshed out by motions and by...
Well, it was a pretty strong signal, wasn't it, that this evidence is coming in and it's going to be fair game?
Your Honor, the information provided to the court was a brief sketch of what the prior conviction would be, and it was a prior sexual offense. Under those circumstances, the court was fully within its rights to suggest that it may indeed be relevant. But the brief sketch that he gave was, the state would suggest, insufficient to make a full ruling.
Was there anything on the record that demonstrated the intention by the state to use that evidence in impeachment?
Nothing, Your Honor. And I've spoken with the prosecutor who indicated to me he made Mr. Fasciolo aware of prior to trial the prior conviction, but indicated in no way that
he has to do that, doesn't he?
Yes. That he had done so, but indicated in neither way that he was or was not going to use it.
So it's not fair for us to assume that if the defendant had testified that the state would have offered the earlier conviction?
It's possible, and then the court would have been presented with the full factual circumstance.
Of course it's possible, but what reasonably intelligent human being sitting on this court would not assume that the state was going to introduce evidence of a prior conviction that they had told defense counsel about? Under what conceivable circumstance would I believe that the state wasn't going to introduce it?
I'm not suggesting to Your Honor that the state would not have used it. However, had it been fully fleshed out, the court would have had an opportunity to rule on it instead of being, as the cases note, a mere speculative inquiry into the decision.
Well, in essence, the tactic used by defense counsel you're suggesting is one that the defendant simply has to live with, and that was he didn't ask for a full, fair Getz ruling, and he went back with the understanding that probably if he did, the prior conviction would be admitted, and therefore he chose not to testify.
Your Honor, the case law is very clear. He had a decision. It was testify or not, and the decision would be made then. The ruling on the prior conviction would be made in the event that he chose to testify, where it can be fully fleshed out, the circumstances of his prior conviction can be discussed with the court. The court has the ability to change its mind either way.
The defendant can also present that in support of a motion in limine before his client testifies, can he?
Certainly.
So he knows whether there is a risk with some definitiveness or not.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And chose not to do it here.
Yes, and on the other side of the fence, the state had done that in Fennell and Walker, and had indicated in advance, gotten the court on notice that this was a possibility. Either side could have moved in limine to discuss this. It was known from the beginning of trial.
Do you know any case law that says that the trial judge's appropriate response to this kind of informal request for an advisory opinion, which is one way that I would characterize it, that the appropriate response is to say, I'm not going to rule at all. I can't suggest anything to you until the entire necessary foundation is before me to determine how to analyze this fact situation under Getz, and say nothing rather than say, I would think it's difficult for the court to not find that a prior sexual offense is not probative of the charges that are here. So the fact that he has a prior conviction for that, I think, would be an appropriate area of inquiry for the state. So that's something you may want to talk to him about and assess the risk of having that admitted to the jury versus telling them this event didn't occur. Now, that's, as I think Justice Ridgely pointed out, is about as clear an advisory opinion as you're going to get. Why is it appropriate to give that kind of opinion before a defendant has decided whether to exercise their constitutional right to testify, but leave a certain openness to it that puts the defendant in a position where he doesn't know what to do in light of that?
Perhaps the trial judge went a little further than would be suggested. However, it was merely a cautionary. You may want to discuss with your client the possibility that this comes in. And from what I can see, putting myself in the position of the judge here, from what I can see, this may be relevant. It may come in. You may want to discuss with your client the possibility that it comes in. And assuming that the trial judge was aware of Fennell and Walker, that when he made his decision that he wants to testify, the decision could be reconsidered.
Okay. So you would characterize this sentence. So the fact that he has a prior conviction for that, I think, would be an appropriate area of inquiry for the state, is only suggesting a possibility that the state will be able to introduce the prior conviction.
Based on what was given to him in the rather informal manner, Your Honor noted, by Mr. Fasciolo, the state would suggest that that's merely an advisory that could be certain. And the Fennell and Walker cases both recognize the trial court can go back, change its mind, can reinterpret the decision based on a fuller understanding of the facts when they're fully fleshed out and presented. And because Mr. Daly chose not to testify, those facts were never brought to the judge's attention.
Okay. And we don't have, at this stage anyway, a complete record of that out-of-court discussion between counsel and Mr. Daly, which led to his decision not to testify.
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
Although we may someday know more about it, right, if we affirm.
Yes, Your Honor. Possibly under Rule 61, that could be more fully fleshed out.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
I would like to try to rehabilitate myself in the limited time available, given the edification provided by the court in its questioning of Mr. Wakely. When I looked at the second issue, I thought Rule 609, and there was a reference to that originally, impeachment by prior conviction. I now see in looking over the record, and I think I appreciate the court's concern. I must have had brain freeze when I looked over this record. The trial court initially addressed 609, but they shifted the focus and went to 404. So under 609, the prior conviction itself, if not outweighed by, it says the prejudice is admissible, but just the conviction. The trial court shifted to 404, and it looked like the evidence concerning the prior offenses would come under 404, which, if they're independently relevant, they would be admissible. And this did have a chilling effect, apparently, on this counsel, because the trial court did make a ruling under 609. Therefore, Fennell and its companion case does not apply. We should not have been anywhere near 404 under these circumstances. It was, if anything, a 609 impeachment by prior conviction situation. And given what appeared in the record, counsel was led to believe that the barn door would be open and, you know, everything gets in concerning the prior offense. That's all I have to say.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement. Recess.